Boardwalk Empire provided an incredible backdrop, which we could tell stories about politics, race relations, and really the formation of modern America.
The beauty of doing these shows is exploring characters over the course of hopefully 3-5 years.
We told the story of Nucky as a leader and as a person, seen through his eyes and with the backdrop of the Prohibition years. That's exactly the story we set out to tell, and I'm really proud of the way we did it.
I certainly feel proud of the work that we've done, and I feel like we're leaving the audience with something that they can enjoy for years to come.
Somewhere back in 2007, I had been given the book Boardwalk Empire by an executive at HBO who told me Martin Scorsese was attached to this project. It was this history book, basically. It was the history of Atlantic City. The eureka moment for me came when I read the chapter about Nucky Johnson, who we, of course, fictionalized as Nucky Thompson. This guy was a TV series waiting to happen.
In less than 2 hours, liquor will be declared illegal by decree of the distinguished gentlemen of our nation's Congress. To those beautiful, ignorant bastards.
The period we chose to focus on was the Prohibition years, 1919 to early 30s, and they were an incredibly tumultuous time in the United States.
In terms of the casting process, you know, first and foremost, we needed our Nucky. We wanted to know who the guy was that we were going to be building a series around.
I got a call from Terry Winter, and he told me that I had the part.
I said, We'd like to cast you in this role.
I said, I know you're still considering other actors, but I really appreciate you thinking of me.
He almost talked himself out of it. But I said, no, this is the call. We want you to do it.
And he said, no, Steve, where I'm offering you the part.
What do you want, Mickey?
Come on, Nuck. The company is hat in hand.
When I auditioned, I did the thing that I kind of do as Mickey Doyle with the voice and the laugh. As I was leaving, Ellen Lewis, the casting director, said, can you come back in and do it again? And this time, they want you to try it and just don't do any of that that you just did. So I did it, and I mean, it was awful. I mean, it was terrible, or at least I thought it was awful. As I approached my first day with Mr. Scorsese, I wasn't totally sure which character had gotten the part. And no one told me.
My pal Maya.
Mickey Doyle, how do you do?
I had an audition for an 18-year-old, tough, Jewish kid from the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And I thought, I'm 30, I'm from London, and how am I going to pull this off?
Mr. Thompson, Oreos man.
I was at home when the phone went, and it was Marty. He said to me, hello, kid, how you doing? I was like, yeah, I'm okay. He's like, look, I got this thing, Boardwalk Empire. And I was like, oh, okay. And he went, I'd love you to play Al Capone. I went, yeah, sure, okay.
I went in, I read, they said, we'd like you to meet Marty. This is all the same day. He spent about an hour and a half talking about growing up Italian in New York. At which point I said, Marty, do you want me to read for you? And he said, yeah, read. I read for him, he said, go to wardrobe.
First, I auditioned for one of the boat captains. And then I heard that they were thinking about me for the brother. And so it got kicked up a notch.
You know, a peculiar thing, say, at the same time the feds are raiding Mickey, this shit's happening 3 miles away.
Isn't that a coincidence?
See, what do you want to say? Yeah.
Background, and act.
The first day on set was a good first day for me because I didn't have any dialogue.
The winter of 88, a blizzard of biblical proportions.
Martin Scorsese was directing and I thought, okay, I can get through the first day.
I had on this costume, very tough to wear in front of all these people you didn't know, you know, and then I had to leap up into his arms and I just heard it all the way up the back. We all had to go in another room and sew it up. It was sort of horrifying.
My first day on set was actually that scene with Michael. One of the crew members, Charlie, he sort of took me aside and said, you know, you need to work on your accent a little bit. And I was like, yeah, but I'm shooting a minute. So I asked Marty if I could have 10 minutes. He went, yeah, sure. And Charlie sat with me and I really listened to Charlie's accent. And I went in and I had to, you know, I had to shake hands with Michael and say, I'm Al Capone.
Nice talking to you, man.
Me too.
Jimmy Darmody. Al Capone.
It was one of them moments where my sphincter was going about 90 miles an hour.
I remember the first table read
I was dressed in my audition suit and had worn a bow tie. And, of course, I was the only one there dressed up. I felt ridiculous.
My first table read was nerve-wracking. The main thing that stood out to me was that I was the only black in the room. I was just like, wow. I had never been the only black in anything before.
My first day on set was like a 14-hour day. And they were like, okay, it's time to go. And I remember Mr. Scorsese was like, we're done. We're done. Like, that's it. That's all we got. I feel like I'm back in the 70s.
I found out what it was to work with Marty. It's like 2 in the morning. He comes in. He goes, great. Perfect. Really good. Perfect. Let's do a few more.
Fine town, Chicago. Yeah, well, it ain't New York, that's for sure.
New York ain't New York now with Prohibition.
It will be if I have something to say about it.
It sounds to me like it brings us to the business portion of our meeting.
In light of recent developments, I thought it might be a mutual benefit for you boys to meet.
I don't recall having had a more satisfying experience with the words that I've been offered to act with.
I like this room. One looks down in secret and sees many things. You know what I saw?
No.
A servant pretending to be a king.
It's just been deeply satisfying every episode. Terry Winter, of course, leading the charge. Howard Korter as well.
I had been a fan of Howard Korter's for a long time before I actually met him.
I had met with Terry and Tim when they were starting to put things together and looking for writers.
He read the pilot. I offered him the job, and he said no. And I called him. I said, well, that's not the right answer. That's not how this is supposed to go. It's supposed to be yes, of course.
I'd worked on a TV series decades earlier. I really didn't think it was for me.
I said, I assure you, it'll be completely different. And, you know, just give it a couple months. And if you hate it, great. No harm, no foul. If you like it, you know, stay.
And so it seemed like a better idea to say yes than no.
Do you have a suspect?
Waxy Gordon comes to mind.
Naturally.
But it's not Waxy. Because Waxy would have to clear it with you, and you would have said no, because you're in business with me.
That could be what I want you to think.
It could. But I doubt it.
How can you be sure?
Because if you were trying to be obvious, you'd never be that obvious.
This is why I enjoy our conversations.
The larger narrative arcs are incredibly well considered. But then the detail that's added, once, you know, you receive the first draft, then you'll receive something that's just slightly tweaked.
If it's the night before shooting, and sometimes the morning of shooting, sometimes during shooting, if there's a better line of dialogue, it'll go in.
In one episode, Howard Korter came back with a little tweak to a side scene, and the line was,
the Negro in question.
I read that, and I just laughed out loud because it was just the perfect accent to the scene that had preceded it, and it was also so wonderfully authentic. And I said to myself, wow, Howard must be a Negro in disguise to have written this.
It is not an exaggeration to say I could not have done this show without him. The show would not have been half as good without Howard Korter's involvement.
We've been on the road for 18 hours. I need a bed, some chow, and then you and me sit down. And we talk about who dies. Huh?
The best thing that can happen when you're writing in this serialized world is you discover things you had no idea you were going to do.
We're creating a series as it goes along. So very often I don't share with the cast where their characters are going, where the story arcs are going, because we're not settled on it.
I think part of the process of not showing the actors what they're going to be doing next provides a surprise for them, and it certainly keeps you in the moment.
Margaret always surprised me. I thought I knew what she was all about, and she gets the job in the dress shop, and then she steals something, and I was like, oh, no, she's not a thief, this can't be.
Good evening, Madame Junet.
Bonsoir.
And so many things that were a shock to me, I thought, well, that's quite good, because it'll be a shock to the people watching.
Early on, there have been, you know, debates with actors about they want to know what's going to happen. And I said, well, if it turns out that the actor you're playing in a scene with in three episodes is your mortal enemy, I don't want you to know that now. I don't want you to play that even subconsciously. So you really shouldn't know that.
You've had your last meal in this place. You're looking very respectable, James. What did he promise you?
More than you ever did.
I keep my promises, and I'll make you one now. I will ruin you. All of you.
It was all very cloak and dagger, which I thought was brilliant. Why should we know everything that's going on if we don't know it as a character? So I was very happy to sort of watch it as an audience member, as a sort of as an avid viewer when it came out.
I watched him from a blind for 3 days. He lifted it to scratch his nose. I put a bullet 1 inch below his eye.
It's really hard to pick a favorite Chalky scene. There are so many beautiful moments that I'm so proud of the way they turned out. But I would go with the scene with him and the Ku Klux Klan member. I ain't building no bookcase.
I was born in Elgin, Texas. My daddy taught himself the carpenter trade, doing for the black folk there.
The ancestral energy that I tapped into for that particular scene was real intense for me.
These here my daddy tunes. What are you gonna do with them? I ain't building no bookcase.
One of my favorite scenes was the scene where I pick up Eli from prison because I got to drive a car.
How, Big Chief? Which way the little big horn?
How, Big Chief? Which way the little big horn?
No luggage, right?
Anytime I get to wind people up, it was good.
The fight scene that Nucky and his brother had, I think, was one of the highlights. It took us 2 days to shoot. I slapped Shay. He's that kind of actor that says, no, just do it. I said, are you sure? He goes, yeah, just do it.
You come crawling back here because you don't have the balls to finish what you started.
We did quite a number of takes of me slapping Shay, and I think it was very painful for him.
Deborah? Hannah?
I always enjoyed the moments that were the more humane moments, like he's trying to name his daughter.
Abigail.
I thought that was interesting.
My favorite scene was in season 4 when Ron Livingston's character lifts the veil and she's just so blindsided.
You and I are here. Together. That's all that matters.
When she discovers that he was playing her,
you get that?
That look of sheer shock and horror that was in her face broke my heart.
And the way they shot it, sort of up above when she runs down the stairs and then sort of almost like an animal trapped. I'll never forget it.
One of my favorite scenes is Jip's scene in season 3 when all the gangsters are sitting around and he verbally destroys everyone.
You smug, kike midget. Creeping around like a fucking dentist with the ether.
Why don't you watch your fucking shit?
Why don't you go sit in the corner, short pants? And then there's you. Fucking breadstick in a bow tie.
I really enjoyed that.
So what are you saying, Mr. Wright?
About what?
About my buying, let us say, 1,000 cases of spiritus liquor directly from you to our mutual benefit.
Cut out the middle, man.
A lot of the fun in getting cast on this was the fact that Terry Winter was involved.
You're not going to turn down the chance to work with Terry. It just was a no-brainer.
When Terry comes down to set, it's like Dad coming down. Everyone's so well-behaved.
When I think back of working with Terry, I think of him as a proud father, and his children are his words.
You do understand. I'm the only thing keeping you from a lynch mob.
You read? What happens here? I turn up on the end of a rope.
You work with Terry, be in for some really intense writing.
Of course, I'd already been a fan of his work on Sopranos and the script of Wolf of Wall Street. That I was really impressed with his clear vision for what Boardwalk Empire could be. And with his enthusiasm and his vision and insight, it was pretty obvious it'd be the right showrunner.
Terry writing at the height of his talent, and then Tim Van Patten, who is a maestro. It's as good as it gets.
Tim Van Patten was the first person I spoke to about joining me as we embarked on Boardwalk Empire.
Gangsters and history and, you know, ensemble. There was no way I wasn't going to do it.
Tim, like Howard, is so incredibly responsible for how terrific this show is. It wouldn't be a quarter of what it is, you know. The right way, I said a half for Howard. Also, Tim's the other half. Okay, it would not be half of what it is without Howard. So the two halves of those guys make up the whole. I don't even need to be involved in this. It's really, it's them.
Tim is everywhere at all times. And thank goodness, he's one of those people that you just know is keeping everything going.
Had enough of the ball on cracks. Name's Duffy now.
What?
I changed it. I ain't Mickey Cusick no more.
Who's after you?
Nobody.
Why Duffy?
Sounds better as all. A rose by any other name.
When you think of a TV show, you pretty much think of, you know, being in a studio and occasionally going out to a location. Boardwalk was the exact opposite.
My favorite location was John's restaurant.
There we were, dressed as Meyer Lansky, Lucky Luciano, Arnold Rossi, and Joe Masseria sitting in the back of John's, as they might have done, you know, those many years before.
Knowing that these characters actually inhabited that space, and it was Joe Masseria's headquarters, that was just fun.
Four Deuces, that was my favorite location.
It was really this beautiful mini estate in Bedford-Stuyvesant that was once the country home of F.W. Woolworth.
It was just always fun in there, do you know what I mean? Not the fact that there were scantily clad women everywhere, but it was just a fun set. It was a really fun set.
I really liked being in Babette's. I thought that was fun when there was entertainment. It was hard to concentrate on what you were meant to be doing. It's a very distracting show to work on.
The sets have always been perfect in the detail.
When you show up in the morning and you see the amount of work that's been put into that, it really gets your blood pumping, because your blood's not always pumping really hard at 5 in the morning.
The set design has been quite amazing. The detail and the sense of place and mood through place has been really spectacular.
I'm always very cautious of sort of not over designing something or overdoing something, because that isn't the point. The point is to support the story and help reinforce the characters.
By far, my favorite set was the Onyx Club. That was another time I would just pinch myself, just be like, this is for me? Really? I'm a part of this?
Wallpaper for me. Curtain hand painted in New York.
These chandeliers.
Sconces. They custom made in Paris.
I don't think the audience will ever really know the amount of detail they put into making that Onyx Club. It was beautiful.
Step right up, friends. What you waiting for? Lovely ladies, direct from Paris. France.
That original Boardwalk set that we only had for 3 seasons was pretty magical.
For the first 2 years, every time I would turn the corner and look up and see that thing, it would take my breath away. It was, I believe, the largest standing set in New York film history since 1915.
When it was finished, you know, Terry and I were walking down this thing going, holy shit, if we don't pull this off, we're in trouble. You know, so...
If I turn up on the board, can there be an elephant there? Crazy, amazing extras.
Rudy, the Congo creep. Poppy, the frog boy.
Every time I was there, it was such an experience.
When Marty first came to the boardwalk, started in one end, it was like 300 feet to walk. And I was there throughout the building of the whole thing, from the very beginning, so I know where all the secret spots are. And he's coming down the set, and he's looking, and says, oh, that's lovely. That's lovely, that's a good angle there. Oh, he's got an angle. And then, oh, that's lovely, that's a lovely angle too. Went right to every spot. I'm thinking, what am I going to do?
When you were on that boardwalk, you were there. The Ferris wheel, the lights, the children running up and down. So beautifully designed, created, painted, and filmed exquisitely.
Sebrard looking to see you. She's been waiting for over an hour. She says it's urgent. She's pregnant.
What? You met her last night?
Last night?
She saw you talk or something. The Temperaments League.
One of the more exciting things about starting a new season of Boardwalk was seeing what suits you had for the season.
We fit every leading character and every background person. Every single one was fit to a T.
John Dunn has people in undergarments, period undergarments. We're not going to see them, but they're in them.
Costumes are very, very important to me, as most things are in film, but costumes I have a special attachment to in creating character and time.
Sometimes I would be on set and I would maybe be feeling like, do I really have the right, you know, Nucky vibe here? And then I would catch just a glimpse of myself in a reflection. I wouldn't see me. I mean, I would see the character. It's like, oh, I'm okay. I'm okay.
I ran the odds on the weight now.
On what?
Whether you'd attempt to kill me.
What'd you come up with?
14-1. Against.
We have wardrobe people all helping dress and tie the ties and do the cufflinks and adjust the suspenders. And Michael really took it upon himself to learn to do all of these things.
Here I am in my room, and I'm using the time to get dressed as a way to get into character. And then all of a sudden you get a knock on the door. Can I tie your bow tie? You know, my world is blown. So in order to keep that momentum and keep that vibe going, I learned how to tie a bow tie.
Michael Spielberg tied a bow tie, which is almost impossible, during a take perfectly. I am lucky to remember my lines.
The collars, the spats, the cufflinks, the bow tie, the hats. You dress for battle in a way that I don't today.
I have a friend, a judge. His daughter's wedding's in a week. I'd like to be able to accommodate him in the
700 guests.
You have a stockpile?
All sold already. I'm coming up short.
Obviously, there have been many features set during the Prohibition period, but there have been very few television series, and none which really dealt specifically with Atlantic City.
As the new head of Prohibition Enforcement in Atlantic City, I do intend to take my duties with the utmost seriousness.
What?
That was a joke. I was joking. I thought you might all appreciate that.
The scope of Boardwalk was amazing in terms of taking it from the beginning, when there was no organized crime, through when we'd leave off, the beginning of the syndicate.
There's a kind of depraved warmth that emanates from the show, and the strange comfort that you find in exploring this dangerous world through the lens of these characters.
Most stories will take fictional characters and have them be the witness to historical characters, whereas Boardwalk does a kind of reverse.
Meyer.
Nucky. Hello.
Been a while.
Ayaz's funeral.
Sad day.
Rest his soul.
This is a great opportunity to explore characters that people knew but didn't necessarily know as younger men. You know, the opportunity to meet Al Capone as the guy who's driving the other guy's car was irresistible for me.
I really love them little scenes where he's at home with his boy or with his wife or with his mother, with his brothers around the table, eating dinner and fighting on the floor and stuff like that. I really enjoyed them.
They're horsing around.
Ain't no more, that's right.
What?
What makes it work for me as an audience member is that it's not just about gangsters. It's about a whole world.
Along with all the beautifully presented explosions and machine gun fire, we actually have shown a lot more of American culture, American history than maybe people had noticed.
The dynamic between men and women was highlighted in a number of different ways.
I come from a country where women already have the right to vote.
Well, in this country, we're simply trying to protect women from the hard truths of life.
By denying them the right to take a meaningful part in it.
I would hope that people really appreciate that world of early 20th century African-American history that was explored.
How we worked with each other and how we interacted with the white community.
Chalky White, the proprietor.
Welcome.
Well, shout out to Chicken Bone Beach.
My hope always is that we are delivering smart, dark entertainment for adults.
Thou hast fulfilled the judgment of the wicked!
Part of doing a gangster show, sadly, is that characters die. And when characters die, the boss has to call the actor portraying that character to tell them that they're written off the show.
I was lying in bed next to my girlfriend at 1 a.m, and I got the sides, and I turned to her, and I was like, yeah, I die. She was like, what do you mean? She goes, does it say that? And I go, no, it doesn't say it. I just know I die. Couple of days later, I got a message on my phone saying, can you call Terry? and that's the phone call everyone knows. So I was like, I definitely die.
He goes, Mike, you know, is that inevitable call that I hate making? I says, how does he go? And he says, trust me, it's going to be beautiful and graceful. I said, that's all I can ask.
I think Terry felt worse for me than I did. He said, it's just the way we were moving the script. I said, okay, thank you. I appreciate it, you know. And I drank 2 bottles of scotch and a gallon of... No, I didn't do any of that.
When I called Bob Clohessy, who played ward boss Jim Neary, I said, Bob, it's Terry Winter. He said, oh, I guess I'm dead.
I always been a little worried that he was going to say, I think now, you know, finally, it's time that you made this call. But fortunately, that has not happened.
One day I did get a message from Terry Winter's assistant saying, asking if I could call back, and he never called. And I was like, oh, okay.
I remember one time I didn't answer my phone, and I get it. Hey, it's Terry, give me a shout. And I turned to my wife, and I said, it's been a nice run, it's done.
Before I phoned him back, I told my husband, well, you know, I think that's us, done.
And I think I held the phone like, hey, Terry, went in my upper register. How you doing?
And then I called back, and it was something completely... I think he's inviting me to something.
I think he said, you know, listen, we'll do a steak. Why don't we get a steak, you know? Yeah, steak would be great, man. He's right. Yeah. I'm good.
I don't think he had any idea, you know, what was happening at the other end of the phone.
I wasn't sure, whether I was going to go or not. I may not be able to be killed by a bullet, but I could certainly be killed by the pen.
Vinny Piazza and, Stephen Grant would say, well, you can't kill me, I'm Al Capone, I'm Lucky Luciano. And I said, yeah, until we do the episode where we reveal that you're actually an imposter, and the real Al Capone comes in, and I kind of was met with these blank looks.
There have been a couple of times when I arrived to set, and one of these scripts that I'm not allowed to read, I'm certain of it. There have been some dead Mickey Doyles in there that have been rewritten.
Could you ask him to put the gun away? Please?
You know, the first rule of show business is to get off the stage while people still want more, and I think we're there.
It's really bittersweet because it's been such a huge part of my life for 5 years.
You must please come this way.
You just feel it in the air on set that it's, you know, very intense and very emotional.
I am really sad about it, but I'm incredibly grateful that I got to experience this in the trajectory of my own career.
I'm going to miss it. It's been such a great ride. All good things, you know?
You look up in 5 years, 5 years of your life, the end of an era.
It's part of your life. It's been good. It could be worse.
The ability to tell the story over 56 hours gave us the incredible luxury of being able to explore our characters, their relationships to one another, obviously. And as a storyteller, this is as good as it gets.